woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome to Spicy Jacks. Come time out. It's Matt Weber on the board. Back from a big softball victory last night. And they're after you guys on Tuesday night, man. Just saying.
We've really had crummy weather every Tuesday, 4 weeks now. I mean, it's to be expected, I guess, in April and early May, but it's nice every weekend, and then it's crummy on Tuesdays. What can I tell you?
Remember the year we were in the... Radio League with the Stacks and Jacks, and it was like, it was damn near a drought summer, yet every Tuesday we had rain.
I do remember that.
Yet the rest of the summer was like a drought, but except for Tuesday night. We were,
yes.
They aimed right for us at Order Park. Anyway, Kevin, how are you? Kevin with us?
Rain in typical Chicago Park District fashion, which means not at all. So every time it rains, it just creates enough powder on the tops, to cover the hard pack field so that when you slide, it's sort of like sliding on your driveway with a layer of dust on it.
Oh, pretty much. S&P up 14, NASDAQ is up 70 coming back from yesterday. Well, we actually did make it a plus on the Dow after it was down like 350, but we still were down in the... we're beating up on some of the tech stocks reasonably well. Well, I'll just give you a quick review of yesterday. Well, since I'm talking about it, Dow made it back up 19. S&P was down 28, though. NASDAQ was down 261. For a while, it looked like NASDAQ might be heading down like 500 or something. It was down over 4 to futures, 400, which is obviously a huge move. Kevin, I was listening to your buddy Steve.
Well, before you ask why, I still have one more question.
Sure.
Softball related. When's the last time you slid into a base?
Me? You don't slide after 40. You don't slide after 40 ever.
Oh, I slid after 40, but not playing anymore. I can't remember the last time I slid into a base, but I would never sacrifice an out for a limb.
I think I kind of had to go down to avoid the tag and like a pickoff move or something, and that type of thing. But I mean, although now the fields are all that real powdery stuff, so they're nowhere near as bad as when we played. The bad part about them now is if it's windy and you're wearing contact lenses, it's a singular challenge.
But you learned your lesson. You learned your lesson then on that pickoff play when you had to go hit.
Oh, God, yeah.
Stop leading off.
I remember when we were, we talked about a long time ago, I was on the All-Star Little League team from Evergreen Park, right? And we weren't very good. There was the Athletic Association, which was like kind of the senior circuit. Then there was us. So I was one of the All-Stars among the schmucks, basically. But we had a guy who came out and he was going to practice us up. I mean, this was if we'd have been good, we'd ended up at Williamsport, but we made it as far as, like, the north side of Chicago, not the north side of Pennsylvania. But first thing we did, we went out to one of the fields like they used to be in the old days. He goes, all right, everybody down on their hands and knees, and he produced, like, 8 buckets. We went across the infield on our hands and knees and pick up all the stones and put them in all the buckets. So we filled up, like, damn near, 8 buckets. And he goes, all right, now let's go back the other way after we dumped all the stones out. Kevin, they, like, multiplied. They were like rats. picked as many up coming back the other way after just doing it. I mean, those fields would multiply.
There was life playing on the Chicago parks.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Did you get any chicken bones in the process?
Who knows? I wanted to talk to you a little, since you do a lot about supply chain management and stuff, and how people, and it's gonna sound like I'm taking a shot at the females today, but I'm not. It's just landing that way. And you know what?
And setting up that comment should be your cue to not take a shot at the females.
Well, but it just so happens the two people I want to talk about are female, and they're in high positions of power. And I'm not saying a guy there'd be any better. I'm just saying they happen to be females. One of them is Janet Yellen, who came out yesterday with, after how many years now has she been saying, she and her successor, Mr. Powell, we're now May, and I'm going to say in January, maybe December, no interest rates, no inflation, not now, not ever, we're not even thinking about it. To sort of maybe temporary, to maybe supply chain problems, to now yesterday she comes out and said we might have to raise interest rates like for a little while because of this inflation stuff. Kevin, it's been 5 months.
Yeah, she backed off of that a little bit too later in the day.
I mean, you know what? But I go back to one female. My mom had a different view of these kinds of things, which I know she had kind of an odd upbringing. But she was a Southsider because she went to work for the Quartermaster Corps in the for the Army. Matt, do you have any idea what that is?
I don't actually.
Actually, the Quartermaster Corps is the people that order and do all the supply chain stuff. So they're the people that are in charge of, you know, shipping out the meals ready to eat and the water and all the other stuff. So when you...
Yeah, they're a logistics team.
Yeah, they're a logistics team. So they go to work at, they were at 39th and Pershing Road. You know where the Chicago Public Schools headquarters were for a while? That was the old Quartermaster Corps building, believe it or not. And then 39th and, like, Damon. And anyway, she goes there, and on Friday, all the colonels and stuff, I mean, they had, like, colonels in the Quartermaster Corps. Every Friday after 12, there'd be this big meeting. And so there would be the Do Not Disturb sign in the office. And so she says, one Friday, they just hired this, she didn't say bimbo. She goes, it's a very attractive young lady that wasn't, like, real bright. She goes, she barges right in the Do Not Disturb sign, and there's this big poker game going on, right? So, so let's just say her views of authority were a little different than a lot of people. But, you know, one day she was telling me, she goes, you know, I don't get it. These people get hired for these jobs with all this alleged talent that when a crisis comes up and, that, you know, on a regular day, let's face it, you don't even need them, right? I mean, who needs the chairman on a regular day? And she goes, but the idea is that when all of a sudden there's a real decision to be made or there's anticipation of something bad, these people have the talent. They're going to see it ahead of everybody else, and they're going to make the right call. She goes, you're basically paying them for once in a while they make the right call. And she goes, you know, it seems like they're making all this money year after year, and all of a sudden something bad happens, and they leave. She goes, they got nothing. And you've been paying them the whole time in anticipation of exactly what? Well, that was her view of the world. Well, yesterday, Steve Leisman, who, you know, and he's good at what he does, but to me, he's like a lapdog for the Fed and these auto companies. So they're talking about Mary Barra. And evidently, she's had 3 or 4 years in a row now where she's made $20 million plus at General Motors. $20 million. That's a real number. And I don't know if the company's doing that well. I mean, you know, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. I don't know enough about it to grade her saying her versus the guy at Ford versus somebody else. And so then they ask Steve, they go, you know, we've got this chip shortage, and then all she's doing is sniveling about this chip shortage. Well, it turns out Toyota anticipated it and bought a bunch of chips ahead, and they're not down production at all, right? Because they anticipated the shortage, and the guy essentially bought ahead. So Kelly Evans goes to Steve, well, why didn't she buy ahead on the stuff? The person at Toyota did, and he launches into this huge dissertation about how, oh man, if she bought ahead and provided capital to get 6 months ahead in the chips and spent money that way, and the amount of criticism she'd be under, she just couldn't do something like that, you know, because of the chance of being criticized for it. And I'm sitting there going, my mom would have slapped him upside the head. I said, what are you talking about? That's exactly what somebody gets paid $20 million a year to do, to anticipate a problem that nobody else sees and deal with it. To just stand there,
anticipate it, deal with it, and if there's any criticism of it, stand up in the face of it.
Yeah.
You know, be a real leader.
Yeah, you don't need $20 million a year for Claude Rains. What do you say? I put my finger up in the air and the winds are blowing from Vichy, Saddam Vichy. You don't need that for $20 million a year. I'm not criticizing him personally. I'm just saying, what does this guy actually think leadership's all about? I'd rather have the guy at Toyota than her or the lady at Toyota. I don't imagine there's a lady running Toyota, but there might be. But I mean, what is? Okay, I would have got criticism, so I didn't do it. Now we're not producing cars in Toyota. Is well. That's no excuse for 20 shekels a year, 20 million shekels, is it? Or is it just me being grumpy?
Well, and so what happens? Instead she gets criticism for not doing it.
And a raise. Well, not really.
And a raise, yes.
And a raise.
I mean, or a nice bonus, whatever.
A nice bonus. I mean, is that the going rate now, 20 mil a year? I guess. Just saying.
It'd work if you can get it.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the little time I spent on a board, it really does seem, the people at the CBOE never really worried about paying the lower level people less. I mean, it wasn't like that was they were all anxious to get the quote reporters down from, you know, $20 an hour to 19. I mean, they weren't like that. Well, because it wasn't their money. They just charge more to the members and pay for it. But, I could absolutely see in one of these meetings, we were in many meetings, Kevin, and our guys weren't even close to being $20 million a year. Matter of fact, they were, you know, 1/20 of that. But I could absolutely see them having some sort of meeting, you know, talking about how they're going to beat the union up on the next contract for half the meeting, have your tuna fish sandwich, and after lunch, figure out how you're going to get the top 10 people a big bonus. I mean, it is so scary how these things operate. I mean, on the one hand, you're designed to pay people at one level as little as you can, and once you cross this somehow line, then the object is to pay these people as much as you possibly can. And I have a hunch she's probably very talented, but I also know that if you put out a we'll pay $5 million a year to run GM, I got to believe the resumes you get might smoke her right out of the room. I don't know, her or him or whoever the hell it happens to be. But we'll never do that.
One of the issues that comes up here in what you're describing is that you definitely do have people who think they're just a better, you know, I'm a better class of people than everybody else. So I have it coming. I have the big bonus coming my way.
Well, if you made it in that group,
we are.
It's like a baseball owner, pretty much. I mean, just look what happened yesterday. Manny and I were talking about it in the weigh-in. Now, the Cubs had the weather was every bit as bad yesterday in game one than it was Tuesday night, but I won't go into their, obviously since they left Channel 9, they mustn't use time skilling anymore for the weather, but, so they canceled the game Tuesday night, and they decide to go
Monday
to,
night.
Monday night, sorry, and they decide to go to a doubleheader yesterday. Now for those that don't follow baseball or whatever, last year because of the COVID and the idea you might have games canceled at the last minute, you gotta play a lot of doubleheaders and you might have people off the team because they got COVID, blah, blah, blah. They did something rational and said, well, if you're forced to play one of these doubleheaders, you should play 7 innings and not 9. And I don't think anybody looking at, I'm sure everybody always disagrees with something, but to me, that made a serious amount of sense. But now yesterday, talk about taking something to the nth degree. You don't have a game Monday night. So instead of having like the White Sox did last week, have a regular old doubleheader the next day where you start at 4 o'clock and one ticket gets you in. No, not Tom Ricketts. He's going to have the 1 o'clock game where everybody's got to leave for 3 hours, throw everybody out, then another ticket, because they are letting people in now, another ticket for the evening game. And now both those games are 7 innings. Now, did anybody ever think for a second that you're going to now have separate tickets, separate games, and you're going to get 7 innings instead of 9? Except for Tom Ricketts. I mean, I'm sure other teams are probably doing it too, but talk about taking something from a pile of reasons to do it that makes sense. Get rid of half the reasons and do it anyway because you're playing two less innings. I mean, why would I want to buy that ticket at 1 o'clock the next day, Kevin, and get for a 7-inning game? I mean, are we taking advantage of something here, or is it just me? I mean, being grumpy.
Do the people who already... did the people who already had tickets for that second game, did they get a 20% discount?
No.
20% rebate?
What about the guys from Monday night? Did they have to use that ticket Tuesday afternoon, Matty, or do you lose the date? It used to be when I had my Cub tickets, even the Tribune, if you got rained out and they're going to make it up on another day, they lost the date, so it was like an opera. You got your money back if you wanted, or you could turn those tickets in and say, okay, the makeup game's in September. Give me a ticket for the makeup game, which they're more than happy to do, by the way. But you could take your thing back and say, I had a ticket for May 10th, and by the way, there was no game on May 10th. I want my money back, and they'd say, fine, and give you the cash. But now you're like forced to go the next day. How the hell does that work? If you go buy a big ticket, I suppose you're bringing...
Are you forced, or are you asking if you're forced?
Well, you're not forced to go. The ticket is now good the next day. So if I had five people from business...
And no good any other day?
And no good any other day. I am correct here, right, Manny?
I think you are, yeah. I don't know for sure, but I think you are.
And for a while, the Trib resisted that. But now I don't think Ricketts resists anything like that. So I think if you had the Monday night ticket and you didn't go yesterday afternoon, you're bleep out of luck. I think. I mean, that's pretty special.
Well, good luck with your pre-sale, if that's your agreement.
Well, I don't think it made any difference.
The weather is oh so predictable.
But, I mean, but the season ticket holders, you don't have any. How are you going to, you're either a season ticket holder or not. You don't get
the. I'm talking about season ticket holders. I'm talking about the pre-sale people.
Okay. But I'm saying for the season ticket holder.
Are you going to go buy tickets for a game a month out?
Well, no, but what I'm saying, if I was this, I mean, a season ticket holder, if I had, I used to bring people from business. We had the four seats. I mean, so if it was a Monday night and all of a sudden I had three guys on the floor or brokers or something I was bringing, and all of a sudden we got rained out, you know, I got the money back. They didn't say get those three brokers and be there tomorrow 1 o'clock or you're out. I mean, I would have thought that was quite the imposition, but now I think they do it all the time. Now, and not only that, it's seven innings.
Yeah, I think for the seven inning games you ought to get a 20% rebound. What do you think of the seven inning doubleheaders? You know, just in general, forget how tickets are handled and just look at
for
it.
For the reason they were put forth. I think a lot of those doubleheaders were the reasoning was we weren't going to be able to play on Monday night because all of a sudden we had eight people that came down with COVID, and by the time we could get eight more people back from Iowa, we're going to have a thing tomorrow. And I think in that regard, last year, given what we were going through, I think it was a really good idea. But I think it's an idea that's time has passed soon. Or if it isn't now.
Do you think it would be a good idea if they would actually schedule more doubleheaders and shorten the calendar length of the season?
If they wanted to do that, if they wanted to say everybody plays, you know, four or five Twilight Night doubleheaders on a Friday, those are going to be seven innings, and we're going to shorten up the season by a week, and that was the
shave a week off of the season.
If that was the reason for it, and that's why you did it, I don't have any problem with it. But the way the Cubs did it this week, a makeup game in the afternoon with a three-hour gap between the next game, I don't see what the reason is with that. So, like I said, that's why contracts are very long, right? Because you have to anticipate every sneaky thing the other person's going to do. Just saying.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm with you. You have to, and even if it's someone you trust, you still need to spell it out in the contract because that'll prevent future mistrust.
I have no regrets whatsoever not having the season tickets anymore. I absolutely have none. I mean, I don't. Games are too long. I can't go. There's no way I can be getting in at 11 o'clock or 11:30, three nights a week, and trying to do the show in the morning. They're just too long, Kevin. I mean, it's just not for me.
The perfect season ticket is college basketball.
Yeah,
you get like 18 games or so, and the games last 2 hours unless you get a bunch of overtimes or something that fits in neatly in a 2 hour time slot. The crowds aren't ungodly huge, so you kind of cruise in and cruise out before and after the game. That is like the best season ticket ever.
Plus, even the money grubbers that sell Ben, the Notre Dame guys, don't charge you for parking, which is unbelievable. But hey,
it is. The nice thing about a season ticket is you see all these games. You really get to see the story of the season. In addition to the games themselves, you because you're that attuned. The whole story of how a season unfolds and, you know, a team comes together is right there for you to observe. And that's the best part about having a season ticket.
Well, the most, I'm going to say intimate tickets I've ever seen between, because the people were there every single game, and the players, since they didn't even wear any helmets, there was nothing as intimate as the Hawk fans back in the old stadium before people wore helmets. Not that that was a good idea, by the way, but you felt like you knew all these people, and you could tell everybody, even the people on the other team, because there was only six teams, you like knew all those guys too, and you knew which guy on your team hated which guy on the other team. I mean, it was about as intimate a setting of sports I've ever seen. I'm sure there's others. I mean, guys probably go to wrestling or something right there or something, but I mean, I don't think there's anything ever like it. Well, the Bulls at the old amphitheater, where you're basically sitting on top of the floor, that was kind of the same way. I mean, you don't really see that too much anymore, but it used to sort of be like that. I mean, you've taken me to a couple of the Irish baseball games. I mean, you're right there. I mean, if you don't know any, you don't feel you know these guys after five games, there's something wrong with you. I mean, you're 8 feet away. You can talk to them, yeah. Right?
Oh, I know. And it's too bad because I can't go this year. They have a great team, and I can't go.
They're not only fans?
Students and family.
You're kidding. Well, yep. All their fans were from South Bend. Not the students didn't used to go.
Well, I don't think they get a ton of students. The arrangement that really works with students in college baseball, and you see this with a lot of the southern schools, and Notre Dame's just, their stadium's not built this way, so they can't do it. But a lot of them build a berm out in the outfield, you know, where and they have this at the lacrosse stadium for Notre Dame, but they don't have it at the baseball stadium. And then when the weather's nice, it just becomes like a picnic or a party out in the outfield, and that's how they get a lot of people at the southern school.
So you could walk by in a fourth inning, and all the various sexes talking with each other. If you ask them what the score is, nobody'd know, and nobody'd care.
Well, there's people, but there are people who watch the game, but there's also, you know, the blankets are out and the picnic is on.
That's
a good way to watch a game, but
kind of sounds like fun, Matty, doesn't it? Just saying.
Doesn't sound bad.
Of course, it might be 100 degrees down south, but, all right, Kevin, I have to ask you, I've heard all kinds of people talk about this chip shortage, and obviously, you know, it has happened. I mean, you've talked a little bit about how maybe people didn't order as many, and you know, there was a fire in some big factory in Texas or a supply place. I mean, there are a couple things that happened, but a couple people have made some comments the last couple of days. It's been going on for, it appears to have been going on for like 6 to 8 months, and yet some people have said, wow, it's going to be like 4 years to catch. How do you get 4 years behind in 6 months? I mean, this must have been going further than that, or there was a couple. Didn't some place in Korea have a fire too, or something? There have been a couple of oopsies in the supply chain. In addition,
So there are disruptions of various sorts. So you know, you look at it and say, yeah, there was you know, this plant had a fire or this you know, whatever. But then you also have the reorientation, the demand shifts, everything going back and forth, and I think, you know, I've mentioned this before. There is something called the bullwhip effect, or demand amplification, depending on whether you want to be technical or cute, and the idea is that the farther away you get from the buyer when you have a big demand shift, like we did last year. The farther you get away from the final buyer, the more amplified it tends to be. That's the phenomenon. And because everybody is shifting around and trying to adjust, and each adjustment, think of it as each adjustment is more severe than the one before. So as you sort of reverse engineer your supply chain, that's where you get the severities, and you don't just turn around and recover on a dime at the root level of production.
It was pretty much after I graduated grad school, but people were talking about it at the time, the concept of just-in-time inventory. What had been on the drawing boards for like a while, but the first plant that I ever heard that did it was the Chrysler plant in Belvedere, correct? When I say just in time,
well, no, it was Toyota in the '70s.
Well, the first plant here that was built that way, I think, was the one in Belvedere.
It would have been in the 80s sometime.
Yeah. And just for those who don't know what I'm talking about, when I was a stock boy at Hi-Lo Foods, my first job, God, was that awful, you showed up with the truck, you know, with all the stuff on the truck, cans of fruit, you name it. You pulled it all off and you put it in the back of the store. So you handle it that way, and then there was this massive spot in the back of the store was, you know, a quarter of the size of the store. And so then when it came time to do the can aisle, everybody brought all the canned stuff out to the can aisle, and everybody stacked all that stuff, and then it was the next aisle the next night. But basically, you handled everything twice, right, Kevin? And people finally said, you know, what's the point of that? Let's just
and you took up space with it.
Yeah, and I know
we're going to go into break, so we should get into this a little more.
Yeah, you know, I just want to set the way it, quote, used to be. I mean, Pullman would get the seats, and they would inventory the seats in a warehouse and those kinds of things. So finally somebody said, hey, wait a minute. Why don't we just get the seats showing up the same day, bringing them right out to the aisle, and we don't even want a warehouse. We might have one just in case somebody really screws up, but we don't even want one.
Because it was expensive to have a warehouse like that. It was expensive, you know, that was space. So, you would just stock all your parts, and the whole idea of economic order quantities factored in there, and you would calculate, you know, what the best deal was versus the carrying cost. But that had a tendency to hide your quality problems as well.
S&P Futures up 15, NASDAQ Futures up 84. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here.
here. Right now. Right now.
Well, North Bay Stocks and Jacks, I'm Tom Allies. Mr. Matt Weber on the board. S&P futures up 16 now, and NASDAQ futures up 84, trying to make up for yesterday. We had two down days in a row, and it was looking kind of ugly there for a while. I mean, the NASDAQ was looking really ugly. As we had, Amazon was down like 100 points or something one time. It's down like 8% from its highs, even though they had great earnings the other day. So some of these high techs have dropped pretty good. The ones that are still moving up are your, not necessarily the gold and the silver, but your other stocks, like your steel companies, your aluminum companies, your Freeport was up every day with the copper. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. Right now, like I said, we've got NASDAQ up 84, we got S&P up 16, we got the Dow up 58. Over in Asia, the Nikkei down 241. Whoa, they haven't traded since Friday. I don't know why they're closed this week, but every day, so I'm going to find out why, and every day I don't. Shanghai, again, is not trading as well. Hang Seng, however, is. They're down 139.5%. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 191, bouncing back from they're a few days down. It's up 1.2%. FTSE up 78, 1.1. CAC around up 47.8. Bonds up one basis point to 1.60. So they're pretty much steady right around there. Even though the more we talk about inflation, the more the Fed must be pouring in, because the bonds are actually going, you would think they'd be going down or going up. Bund up 2 basis points to 21.21. Japan unchanged at positive 0.09. UK up 3 basis points to 0.83. So UK has been moving up, even though the Europe has not been doing it. That's really interesting that the right across the channel, it's minus 0.2, and yet the UK is positive 0.8. I mean, it's, I don't know how that works out over there, but it, somehow it does. Oil up 67 cents, 66.36. That's up another 1%. So oil just keeps moving up. So how is it, and this serious question, Mr. Weber. When Trump got in, he was going to do everything for the steel companies. They went straight down the minute the guy got in. This guy is supposed to be the absolute bane to all regular energy, traditional energy, carbon energy, and positive for all electric cars and everything. The electric car stuff is going straight down since he's been there, and oil's going straight up. Explain to me how anybody would look to trade that way. Yet it's worked now two presidents in a row. Brent up 77 cents, 1.1. Natural gas up a penny, 2.98. RBOB up another 2 cents, 2.17 on RBOB. Gold up $1.90 to 17.77. Still can't get to 1,800. It's tried a couple times. Silver down 13 cents, 26.42. Copper up another 2 cents, 2.54. Although it actually was 4.54. It was actually 2.460 the other day. So it's kind of hovering at near these highs. Palladium up another 22 bucks, 3,000 on palladium. That's got to be another record. And we've got crypto up 800 bucks, 55,289. Ethereum, which has been up how many days in a row? Actually, it's down 34 bucks, a full percent this morning. Matty, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
37 minutes past the hour. Good morning to everyone out there. Off to a decent start on the area expressways, roadways, and tollways. We do have pretty heavy traffic volumes for this early in the morning on both the Eisenhower and the Stevenson. No accidents to report, but a lot of high traffic volumes in both directions on those two expressways specifically. If you're coming in on the Ryan, I-57 on the Bishop Ford, it's looking pretty good, normal for this hour. Lakeshore Drive's quiet in both directions. Edens and Kennedy are off to a good start as well. And then out in the suburbs, you're looking good too. Just coming in from the west on I-290 and on I-55, you'll see a lot of brake lights as you're heading in. Off the expressways, we have one significant crash in the area. That's Route 83. On the northbound side at 3rd Avenue is backed up to the I-290 expressway due to a crash that happened a little bit ago. And that's a big intersection out in the western suburbs. And then up north, Elm Street between Locust Road and Burt Street is closed due to road construction in Winnetka. That starts today. That work is scheduled to close Elm Street in both directions between Locust and Birch until late June. So Pace is rerouting the 423 buses, and you'll have to take a different route up in the northern suburbs. Everything else all quiet out there. Weather today, lots of sunshine, but still cold temperatures, about 15 degrees below normal, as we'll reach a high of just 51 today. Right now it's crystal clear and 44 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, they're warming up down there. Partly cloudy skies with a high of 99. Right now it's clear and 66. In sports, the Cubs had a tall task in front of them, facing two Cy Young Award winners in a doubleheader yesterday. Clayton Kershaw in the afternoon game, and then Trevor Bauer, the Cubs' nemesis in the night game, and yet somehow the Cubs swept the mighty Dodgers, winning 7-1 in Game 1 behind a complete game, one-run performance from Kyle Hendricks. Of course, that's a seven-inning game. And then the night game actually went extra innings, so they played a full nine-inning game in the nightcap, and the Cubs were down 3-1 in the bottom of the eighth before Javier Baez hit a two-run bomb to tie that game, and then David Bodie walked it off in the ninth. Cubs win that one 4-3.
The guy who scored, the guy who started the game, started the inning on second?
Yes. White Sox had no problem going to Cincinnati in interleague play. They absolutely blew out the Reds last night. They got a lead early and kept tacking on, and they beat Cincinnati 9-0. White Sox are now tied with the Royals for first place in the AL Central. Diamondbacks lost big to the Marlins 9-3. In hockey, the Blackhawks were eliminated from playoff contention a couple of days ago, and now they're just playing out the season. They were doubled up by Carolina 6-3 last night.
And they started the first period, they were 2-0. They actually had the first best period I've ever seen them play this year.
Yeah.
And even then they got beat, what, 4-1 the rest of the way or something?
6-1 the rest of the way, yeah. Bulls were off last night. They return to action tomorrow night at Charlotte. Suns played. They blew out the Cavs 134-118. Chief.
We have all kinds of things here to talk about. I want to start with, I just saw this thing about Jamie Dimon. He's done with Zoom. He's had it. Yesterday, for months now, many, many months, we've listened to people saying, I'm never going back to work, you know, especially people from like the Fed. I'm never going back to work. I'm moving further away, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, in the last 3 days, like virtually every big firm, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, said basically you're going to be back to work in June, like it or lump it. And pretty interesting turn of events, Matty. I mean, when people kept telling everybody how productive they were at home. I don't think these companies think they're productive at all at home. And I don't think anybody thinks they were productive in a Zoom meeting, at least not every single time, every single day. Some firms are really pushing back right here. And I don't think they're asking for a debate. I'm saying they're saying get back to work. Just saying, I don't, you know, it appears that's what's happening. It doesn't mean that people are going to conventions and everything right away, but it sure seems like this has been a big shock for some people that have moved 60 miles away, all of a sudden have to be back at work. It appears. I mean, how many people in New York?
Yeah, there's another phenomenon that's going to be part of it, too. And that is that with everybody being away for a year, when you put them all back in, you know, and say, everybody come back, they're not going to pick up where they left off. This is going to be like you have a whole office full of people who are starting a new job.
Yeah, yeah.
With you know, the anticipation, and there'll be, you know, people will be happy about it, and so on. All of that'll be good, but it's also stressful starting a new job. You know, fitting in, people, you know, sort of refiguring what their roles are in the office and how they fit into things. And this is, I think this is going to be a big management challenge because there's a lot of people that really don't understand team development very well. And so as they start getting everybody back, they're going to have to redevelop their teams. And they're going to have to lead them through, you know, all of that stress and, you know, people starting to say, you know, you stay in your lane, that's my role, throwing an elbow, you know, whatever, you know, a virtual elbow. All those kinds of things that come into play are going to be part of the dynamic, and it's going to take a long time, and you're going to have all these dysfunctional teams around, and it should be interesting to watch that unfold.
Well, they had, again, not going into the personalities of it, but Lori Lightfoot was catching no end of crap this weekend by saying she wants people back in school. And it is interesting. I mean, how News Radio 7?
I thought everyone was already back at school.
Not everybody.
Really?
I don't think all the kids, I mean, somehow or another.
I think public schools have been open now for like a month.
They've been open, but I don't think you all had to be there. I think you could still do some stuff from home and whatever. But they had these people, and they all happened, they were interviewing, you know, administrative people, maybe the administrative people in it, but basically they were on there and they were worried, you know, they were talking about the disease, but basically the message was It's inconvenient for me to go to work. What am I going to do with my kids? What am I going to do this? I mean, it's always been inconvenient to go to work. That's why you call it work, right? I mean, I'm not, you know, obviously, I don't have to pay for kids at home and stuff, so I'm talking out of the side of my head for a little bit, but the fact is, I mean, basically, if somebody were to listen to what they just said, they would say, wait a minute, what did I just say on national radio? It's inconvenient for me to go to work. That's probably not the right message. But, I mean, if some people are convinced now that this is, they're owed this, that, you know, they need to be at home and, like, who's going to walk the dog? Well, I didn't tell you to go get a dog. It was your decision, that type of thing. But, hey, Kevin, I want to get back to the, as somebody who was involved in the theory of this, you know, just-in-time inventory and how these places became really a lot more efficient, but then I went off and did something crazy like traded options on the trading floor and kind of lost track. The places like in Belvedere, now the theory was, theory is always terrific, that basically nothing in the plant was ever going to be inventoried. I mean, you didn't even have a screw and nut cabinet in case that didn't show up. Nothing was going to, maybe you had a little bit of something, you know, where you put the doors on the car that you might have had a drawer with some extra screws in case they didn't show up. But how did that ever make it through in terms of the theory? It seems to me that if, you know, you want it in such a place where if the transmissions don't show up, if there's an accident or something, or the motors don't show up, you've decided you're going to stop the production for a day because of that. But you're sure as hell not going to do it if the screws that, you know, put the door on don't show up for a day. I mean, there's got to be some level of part. I mean, I'm going to say in an automobile, I'll just take a stab at it, there's 2,500 parts. In a railroad car, there's, you know, 50,000. And in a plane, there's got to be, what, 500,000? I mean, you're not going to have all 500,000 parts. That if one of them doesn't show up on a day, you can't do anything. I mean, obviously, there's workarounds.
Yeah, shut it down, send everybody home.
So what degree did this...
Okay, so in the perfect just-in-time world, you don't get a part until you need the part.
Right.
Right? And in the perfect theoretical world, it's one-to-one. Now, in practice, it's not going to work out that way. As you go down a production line, it may. So you may have some raw materials inventory, and as you go down a production line, if you have a faulty part, you have to stop the line until you can retrieve the part that you need, and even that's expensive. So the idea behind just in time originally was, and this is why Toyota invented it in Japan. They wanted to do mass production, but they don't have enough space in most Japanese cities for you to be able to sprawl out and stock all kinds of inventory and so on. So they just went to a tighter control where everybody produced everything in smaller quantities, and they kept the flow going, and that worked out. But the real benefit realized was that you no longer can hide at your quality problems. You can't say, I have, you know, or let's take a big number, a ridiculous number, like say I have 5% faulty parts. Well, if I have 5% faulty parts getting, you know, coming in, every time I find one, I just throw it aside and get the next one. Well, you can't do that in just-in-time world. Now, does that mean that you have, one part at a time coming in your door? No, you can't do that. That doesn't make sense. But does it mean you have a daily delivery or a twice-a-day delivery of parts so that you can keep the quantities very, very small and just keep them in a staging area? Yeah, that's where it goes. So it's not like you have none, but you don't have a lot of margin for error.
Right, and where is it? But how does that jibe with we're only going to, I mean, I'll use the term in the Belvedere plant again. I'm beating this one up. I mean, in theory, when a car shows up, somebody's walking up with a dolly with four tires on it, and you slap those on, and the next maybe eight for two cars in a row or something. But I got to believe it at least got to the point where you had a rack at the tire spot, and you had enough tires there that you knew you were good for the day, at least to stock them the night before. I don't.
Yeah, that would be reasonable. Or you have a staging area, so you never actually check anything into inventory per se. It just comes in on your loading dock and your receiving area, and you have a staging area where it goes right there, and that's what you need for today. Yes, you can. In practice, it works that way. Now, if you start backing up, somewhere in the supply chain, and it could be the one that's making the delivery to the plant, or it could be, a couple of steps down the chain. But sooner or later, somebody's got to hold some inventory, especially when you're talking about parts that may be made overseas and that travel on a cargo ship, and cargo ships take 4 to 6 weeks to get things to their destinations, or when they're involved, and you may unload it and load it on a freight train, and it may have to get halfway across the country. So sooner or later, someone's got to hold inventory. It just ain't the one with the buying power. The end producer is the one with the buying power, and if you're big enough, you can demand just in time, because you are, you're the big player in the arena.
Well, how bad? Because we're starting to see, and what I'm trying to do is give the listeners, because I've been out of it for a while, some sense of what, because this is major choreography here. This stuff. Because I was on the other end of the broom at Pullman, because their issue was we had problems with changes in the cars that the customer wanted, and we meaning Pullman was never able to because we were never set up that way, and we didn't have computers and stuff in those days or the ability to really know what the hell you were doing. We could never estimate in a car that complex how much it would actually cost us to have a delay, because we were trying to do, again, the word "we" means Pullman, somewhat of a just in time. So the people that we contracted for, like the trucks, which are the wheel and axle thing, they're pretty neat looking when you see them when the car's not on top of them. We had all those delivered. We were delayed for like a year. Those were all delivered. We had to make tracks and the property to hold the wheels and axle together. We had to rent warehouses for the seats and the air conditioners, because we had just the opposite problem. Because now if you've got, let's say 1,000 parts coming in just in time, and you all of a sudden have a problem with, say, chips, well, you've contracted these other people to get the stuff there because you're supposed to be pumping out, a railroad car a week, and they're bringing you a wheel and axle combination every 4 days or 5 days, and their contract says they're bringing it. So you, A, got to pay for it, which is a problem because you don't have any cash flow because you're not delivering anything. And, oh, by the way, you got to find a place to put it when you had decided we never have to store these things because we're going to be putting out a car the same week, so they're going to come in and we're going to drop, a car on two of them, and there they go down the track. With the car on them instead of sitting on a track by themselves. So the other question is for the people at you keep using the Belvedere plant, what do you do with all the other parts that keep showing up when you can't make any cars because there's only chips? I mean, you can put a hold on a few of these people.
You start canceling orders, and you start having things that don't show up, and now you get the chips, and you have to re-energize your supply chain for all of the other parts, and get everything back into balance, and that's going to take months. So even if we get our hands, even if somebody says, okay, the floodgates are open for chips tomorrow, then everything else that's been adjusted has to adjust back.
This is why
when I keep saying everything's out of balance, this is what it means to be out of balance. Everything kind of had its various equilibriums were established, and now they're all out of whack, and they don't all go back into equilibrium again all at the same time.
No, I mean, well, in some of the stuff, you just may have to, as the transmissions in Belvedere are piling up, and they're coming from Maddie Weber's transmission manufacturer in South Dakota, you might find yourself the proud lessor or lessee of a big warehouse in Nebraska for 6 months just to hold the stuff, right?
You very well could.
Which is really inefficient, but that's what has to happen. They have to be somewhere. I mean, I guess you could leave money.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you're going to slow down production. I mean, this is where we are, and this is when we shut everything down. I don't think anybody thought that through. I don't think anybody realized the real implications that even if we had done it for 3 weeks, as originally planned, the 15 days, I think that was it, 15 days to flatten the curve. Even if we had done it for that, that would have caused a certain amount of havoc. Now, months later, how much havoc have we caused?
Well, that's, I mean, I think we get back all the time, Kevin, and not a right or a left. I mean, because, you know, Maddie's always involved in these arguments with us. But that's why when you talk about the people who, and I'm always arguing when people say politicians, you know, they don't have a, it's not run like a business. And I keep saying it's run exactly like a business. It's just a different business. I mean, that's why I think that when you have people from the military, not that that makes them any more, you know, I'm going to say smarter in terms of politics than anything else, but I think at least people who have military experience that make it up to general, even if they're not, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer, they at least have some kind of an idea of the millions of things that have to happen, like for an invasion to happen, or for some sort of a air attack, or whatever it is, or air defense, or something. It's not just one or two things, two people giving a speech, and it all happens. It's, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, or hundreds of thousands of people working together, and everybody's got a job to do to make something at the end happen. They at least have some kind of an idea like that, where we have a lot of people in that I believe that are in politics right now. They're, you can't say they're not good at what they do because they're in power and we're not. I mean, I'm sorry. It's like saying Mitch Trubisky has no idea how to play quarterback. Yeah, he does. He's in the NFL. He's just not one of the best in the NFL, but to compare him to you or me is like, why even go through the process, right? You can't do that.
I'll go even further because your military comment is spot on in that the military is all about logistics.
Yeah.
And that is what you do in the military, and they're really good at it. You know, they may not be good at procurement all the time. You know, they may be pretty wasteful in the procurement process. And there's, you know, there's other areas where they're lacking, but they're really, really good at logistics.
Well,
when I lament, you know, sometimes, that, you know, complicated tax codes and crazy lobbying and jiggering the laws and everything that we do that diverts talent into both law and accounting and finance and tax and things like that, that it diverts it away from making stuff. This is what I mean, because we have a lot of decision makers in the business world who don't understand logistics very well. Their forte is marketing. Their forte may be tax and accounting. If you come up through the financial route, but you don't have that many people at the top of corporations, and certainly not at the top of government, that have operations experience and that really understand what goes into making things.
Well, and I think the whole concept of making government work for you. I mean, I was telling everybody about the Employee Retention Act. I was reading some of that because I'm trying to read some of this for. Some of my clients have questions, and by the way, I like to talk about it on the show, so I'm supposed to know something. And Kevin, it took me, honestly, I read a half of the first page, and I said, some restaurant people, they had their lobbyists write this thing. I mean, it was so obvious that quick. I mean, how can I figure that out, and politicians can, or maybe they can, and just didn't care. But the whole idea, I mean, I don't think that, you know, PTI deserves a whole bunch of scratch for doing business last year. It was a time of, we were able to stay open, we were able to take care of our clients, and we were okay. It wasn't like we had clients coming in every day because we couldn't, you know, we didn't get a whole lot of new people because we couldn't go meet them, you know, so that's a problem. So yeah, was it our finest hour, our finest year? No, for God's sake. You know, would it have been a hell of a lot better if we could meet people? I used to go to meet people halfway to their house or, you know, we meet at the Starbucks or someplace and, you know, we'll talk about investing and maybe we get a new client, maybe I don't. I mean, but I'm saying I wasn't able to do any of that. Okay, so I'm not saying that PTI deserved anything for that at all. If nobody else got any, right? But of course, that's not what happened. Now you have, people just throwing money around like, you know, that you know, the dreams of avarice couldn't even conceive of this money being flipped at people. Now every restaurant around that you see that was able to stay open and do the carry out stuff or had to drive in or anything like that, I'm going to say every single one of those, with the money they're getting from government, had the best year they ever had last year. Because if you closed down your bar, they had five stools, and you delivered 500,000 pizzas a day, you were considered partially closed. Yet, a bank or a securities firm that was, maybe we got two people in here through the one bridge I knew that was open with the riots and everything, we weren't considered partially closed. Because there was nothing that says there wasn't no edict that said we couldn't come into work. Matter of fact, we were allowed to come into work. So, I don't have a problem with PTI not getting a dime. I do have a problem when every single restaurant has their whole year made up for it. Not the ones that closed, obviously. We don't care about them. It had their whole year made up to where they had like their best year ever. I don't think that's all that cool. Do you, Kevin? You know, by the definition, whose lobbyists got in?
But you know, it's sort of the consequence of, you know, one bad decision forcing the next one. You know, forcing the next one to the forefront, and then and decision making on the fly. What happens when you're making decisions on the fly? Let's just forget all the lobbying and anybody, you know, worming their way into a position of preference, and let's just look at the decision making process itself. You know, when you have time to think through a decision, do you make a better decision generally?
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
When you make decisions on the fly, you might as well throw a dart at the board and see what you get.
Well, but when money's involved, you're always motivated to make the wrong decision in politics. I mean, I think the motivation is always to bleep up.
Yeah, that's part two. And that's why I said, you know, originally I said, forget it for a minute and just talk about, about the just the process of making a decision. So, you know, now we have the double whammy. We have the people who have thought about it and who can think on the fly, and they're in influencing the politicians, who are very, very easy to influence as it is, and the politicians haven't really thought through the implications. So all of this stuff is happening in a swirl of just a really icky environment. And you know what? If we had stuck to the 15 days, we'd be better off. If we had never done the 15 days, it was, you know, all of this has been panic decision making on the political side.
Well, I knew how to influence in Vegas at a young age, Kevin. When I walked into the show, if I put $20 in the maitre d' stand and say I want to sit down there, it always worked. Very, very close to politics.
Now it's going to cost you a C-note.
Might do that. Well, yeah, you know, but the tickets back then, they were like $15, and you got like four drinks to see, like, you know,
that's not bad.
Rodney Dangerfield or something. Johnny Carson was more; he was like 25, but you got four drinks or four beers or three drinks, which was always a question. Which would you want to have, three kind of crummy drinks or four beers for the same price? It was always a decision.
Depends on the brand of the liquor.
Oh, you got Heinekens, and you got the real stuff, I think. Anyway, Kevin, yeah, thank you.
And you didn't get rock cut scotch is what you're saying.
No. SP Futures up 16, NASDAQ Futures up 89. We'll be right back. Mr. Russell Rhodes.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's Matt at StocksandJocks.net.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. Do you know when the unofficial start of real estate season is in the Chicago area? It's actually right after the Super Bowl. Yep, it's the time when the guys will finally get off the couch and the families start looking for homes in the area. Now, interest rates also have been hovering around 4%, and the selection of properties are great. And if you're a first-time home buyer, there is an Illinois program that allows you to purchase a home for only 1% down. And that also applies to anyone who hasn't owned a home in the past 3 years. So if you're thinking about it, this is the perfect time. Call or email me, and I will send you a free list of homes designed to your specifications in your area. My phone number is 708-349-3456, or you can email me, AudreyJohnson at Realtor.com. That's AudreyJohnson at Realtor.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now.
There's something happening here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Holly. Just Matt Warman on the board. S&P futures up 16. NASDAQ futures up 89. Trying to bounce back from yesterday. And we're halfway back on the S&Ps. We're nowhere near halfway back on the NASDAQ. NASDAQ with 1 point yesterday was, I saw it down, pushing, was over 300. I mean, almost pushing 400. The question is, where are we going to go to? I saw it down 399, the futures, Russell. I don't know if they ducked below 400, but it looked like we might have 500 written on the wall, but then came back the other way a little bit. But still, like 300, which is long, which is a big move. And now we've had, the Amazons of the world and the Googles have had a pretty reasonable correction, even though they all had pretty good earnings. It's kind of interesting, a movement within the market. And then other things are shooting up. Where all of a sudden we're seeing, in one man's sort of opinion here, and obviously feel free to, any place that we have figured out that there's any pricing power. GM is up today because they had earnings, but people have figured out that the old adage, and nobody likes to hear this, but there is no such thing as a shortage. It's just too low of a price, right?
No, that's one side or the other, but yeah.
But it's not a nice thing to say, but it's the truth.
And did you cutting right to our favorite topic, inflation. Did you see that Warren Buffett said we've got inflation on the horizon, and they're already seeing it?
What Warren Buffett said was.
Did you spend all day Saturday watching?
No, but I did watch all the Cliff Notes, and I wanted to regale you with. Yeah. I don't want to take a shot at the female of the species, but a lady was on yesterday, and she looks to me like she's going to be a future Karen. She was just irate. at Charlie Munger's comments about Bitcoin. So she.
Oh my goodness! Oh, I know.
She had two words out of her mouth, and I immediately said, "Here's a lady that has Bitcoin, has been telling other people to buy it, and now some guy said it's basically worthless." And she was outraged, and she was doing stuff that you could never do on national TV if you weren't. He's too old to understand stuff like that. He doesn't get it, and what a.
Okay.
And then he said something to the effect where it has no basis in wealth. I mean, there's nothing behind it. And oh, by the way, I don't think it. We need something that's designed just for people to get around rules and for a bunch of drug people to be able to make transactions in it where nobody can find them. And she launches into this whole thing about the banks that they've been involved in and how. They've been fined for money laundering and stuff. The key part she missed there, I think, is the banks have been fined for money laundering. There is, and you and I will talk forever
which
about.
Means,
how,
which, yeah.
I mean, we'll talk forever about.
Which means they could get caught.
Yeah. Which about how strict we are with the banks and so forth. Yeah, and to be perfectly honest, I think the biggest problem that the banks have with the money laundering stuff is the government's not doing their job. And we could talk about that. We probably should for a few minutes, but. The reason why they're after the banks is because the banks aren't doing the job of law enforcement to the extent that the law enforcement wants them to. I mean, they couldn't wait. They raked Deutsche Bank across the. They tarred and feathered them regarding how many of the forms they fill out for money laundering. They never once But they filled out the forms. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. Then they got accused of being money launderers. Those things are supposed to be investigated by the FBI. They didn't do it, right? Then they went back. They went back at the bank.
They gave them the form. They did their part and turned it over. And
yeah.
The government said you didn't do enough.
Well, for those what we're talking about here. Sometimes when I talk to Russell, we kind of elevate the conversation, maybe. But if you go into a bank and you plunk down $40,000 or something, or $50,000 or
$100,000. Well, I know this for a fact, but I know how this works. I was a bank teller years and years and years and years ago, and if somebody came in with a big wad of cash, I was actually supposed to fill a form out that got sent over to the government that said, it was $10,000.
Yeah.
And then there was another another threshold for $3,000. I can't remember the two things. And I mean, we were trained as tellers. If somebody came in and like went to, you know, brought in a big bag and went into the room with the, with all the safety deposit boxes, and they came in four times a week, if we thought it was suspicious, we were supposed to let the government know. And they would come in and they could come in and crack open the safety deposit box. And then if there's a bunch of cash, like, you know, from Breaking Bad, that person needed to explain what the source of the cash was. And I mean, yeah, the government totally was expecting the financial institutions to basically be the cop.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody really wants that, to be honest with you. I mean,
I always felt like, I don't know, that it was crossing a line as far as people's privacy went.
Well, it's not illegal to have cash.
Yeah, I really did. I just remember being trained, you know, on what you were supposed to report, and I was thinking, you know, if people realize that their bank that the people that they hand their money over to are being trained to keep an eye on them for the government, they may be a little bit less enthusiastic about a bank.
Well, I would agree. And the whole idea that if you feel, I mean, there are people that have reached the stage where they do think that everything everybody else has done is their business. And I honestly think that if you probably get, you know, cars that are worth $40,000, but in theory, if I bought one of your used Mercedeses and bought it for $40,000 and I gave you the cash, why exactly, there's nothing wrong with a Mercedes being worth $40,000, that's what they go for. Why all of a sudden is it a big problem for me to pay you? Why does everybody have to know? I mean.
Try buying a house.
Yeah, try buying a house, yeah. But that is so insidious. How does stuff like that, what does Kevin say? It happens gradually and then all of a sudden? I mean, I bought a house back in the day, a couple of them that we were remodeling, and one thing I was always told is, in case somebody slips on their calculator, always bring $300-$400 to the closing. Because in case, you know, somebody starts bitching about you left the garbage can in the wrong spot, you can always say, here's an extra, $100 cover it, and somebody said, now you can't do that. You have to wire that in. And here's two people having a transaction.
You can write a check apparently up to $1,000.
Now that's new.
That's the rule that we were told.
Okay, that's new. Because a year ago, Audrey will tell you.
But everything has to be wired otherwise. Yeah. But I think you can write a check for up to $1,000, and that's the max.
And I will bet you, a beer, Mortimer, that there's been more wires stolen than checks or cash that have been messed with between those in closings in the last year. Audrey will tell you stories about wires get stolen all the time.
I wouldn't doubt that at all.
Yeah, so it has nothing to do with your safety. It has to do with somebody keeping an eye on you. And who the hell is the somebody?
Well, not only that, you know, I've talked about this on the air, and you guys probably know it, but I just went through this for the first time buying a place. The idea that, you know, you save your money for a period of time. You know, you don't just get a gift from your mom or something. You actually work and save your money enough to get a down payment on a place. And then you write them a check and they say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Where did you get this money? It's none of your business where I got this money. How about I work?
I know.
Right. So you have to show like all of this documentation of you know, what money market account did you have? When did you transfer it to your joint checking account? You know, what did you liquidate? Where did it come from? Show us the statements and all that stuff. And I'm like, I mean, if, talk about an invasion of privacy, even though we have nothing to hide, obviously, but that's not the point. It's like, Jesus.
Manny, I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a very personal question. Nothing to do with you and Venkman, his lovely dog. I'm going to say, I've talked about this a few times, okay, and I'm not asking you chapter and verse of when I did it. When I talked about it, I'm going to say, again, tell me I'm wrong, your eyes glazed over, and what's this old fart talking about? Who gives a crap? But now that you actually went through it, how much difference does it feel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my eyes necessarily glazed over, and I do remember.
I'm not
accusing you.
I'm not saying that because you're more attentive than just about anybody. So
yeah, but
I'm just giving you. How many people say that's such BS? Who even cares? It'll never happen to me, and then it does.
Well, a lot of people's sentiment, just in general, about their privacy being invaded, whether it's by the government or by big tech companies or whatever, say, you know, to the effect, we hear this all the time. Well, I don't have anything to hide, so who cares? And I get that, but. It still just kind of rubs you the wrong way, or at least it did me.
Yeah, what do they care if your dad gave you the dough? Isn't that what dads are supposed to do?
Right, but I totally agree. Who cares where you got the money? But the whole idea that you just worked for the money and saved it, and it's your money, and it's almost like they don't believe you or something like that bothers me too.
Well, what if you? Have your job, and Jill's got her job, and you guys are, you know, you're the couple that everybody in the country wants to be. Honest, nice people, both have a job, do a good job. I mean, you're the America that needs to be. But who says that you don't, you're one of these serious worker kind of guys, and once in a while somebody calls you up and says, hey, I got a painting contract this weekend, and you run over and you make $200 a day on a Saturday and a Sunday helping your cousin paint. And you save all that dough, and one day you put it in the bank, and there's an extra $10,000 from nowhere. Well, now all of a sudden, what are they going to do? Say, where did you get this? And you can't explain it. Did you pay taxes on it? Did you declare? Why does anybody have to know?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of people. I mean, the reason why there's cash around, I don't necessarily want somebody to know that I won $50 in the Kentucky Derby pool this week. Why do they need to know? The fact that they want to know makes me want to not tell them. Is that just me or what? Where are we going with all this? I mean, it's just saying.
Well, it seems like there's this big macro thing that we're, and you can see it in a lot of aspects of society where we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, but a lot of people are now having to prove innocence in more and more places.
That's exactly
like
right.
You got a big stack of cash. Tell me where it came from, or you're guilty.
Well, Sweden, you've traveled the world over. I know you're like Marco Polo, for God's sake. Have you ever been to Sweden recently?
Not recently, no.
I've never been. I went to Denmark up once, and but evidently they've been pushing against this cash forever, and they've reached the point. On a national level, that if the three of us walk into the bar or wherever, coffee shop, I'll be nice, and there's order three double secret coffees that are $10 a throw, and I wing 100 up on the bar, or the coffee shop table, the entire place is going to stare at me and say, that guy must be a drug guy. What's he doing $100? Why isn't he charging it? That's where they are. But you can only do that stuff if you indoctrinate your population. I mean, right now, I mean, people are saying, "Oh, we should know where the guy got the $10,000." Why? Why? I mean, what possible reason?
Why is it in your business? Yeah.
Just saying. Hey, so how did we go from? Let's see. 6 months ago, you were on your buddy Paul. By the way, did he come over to your house for dinner again this week? Your buddy Paul.
And it was nice because now that we're all vaxxed, we could actually, you know, sit real close and whisper to each other.
Oh, God. So we were never going to...
You started it, man.
Yep. we're never going to have any even thought about raising interest rates. There's no inflation. We're so far away from tapering that we don't even think about it to where, oh, there might be a little inflation, but it's short term. Then we had the buffoon the other day that came in from Berkman or whatever the guy's name was. He said about how there's been no inflation, and couldn't have been an hour later that Warren Buffett and Munger. The only thing about being old is you almost don't care what people care. I mean, you think Charlie Munger cares what anybody says about him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what do he say?
Yeah.
He goes, everybody's raising prices to us, and all we're doing is raising prices. And everybody's like, listen to these two old guys. They mustn't really be doing that. They're lying to us. Why would they be lying to you? They're saying the guys own 50 companies, for God's sake. They're saying we're raising prices as fast as we can. And, oh, by the way, people are raising everything we buy for everybody else is going up. Why would anybody even remotely think that that's not true? And meanwhile, the guy from the Fed's going, oh, there's none of this happening. I mean, how would you like to be a Fed chairman saying something like that on national TV, not a chairman, the other guy, on national TV, and 2 hours later, these two old guys are sitting there going, what is that idiot talking about? We're raising prices today. We're doing it right now. As soon as I get off this podium, I'm going to raise some prices. I mean, who would you rather believe?
You believe the people that are, you know, that are seeing that are actually on the front lines as far as seeing what pricing power looks like right now on both sides of it, as opposed to somebody that gets a whole lot of statistical reports that end up being, you know, maybe interpreted by a bunch of freshly minted PhDs for them. So
I don't see
you're going to believe the person that's basically the textbook part or the real world part.
And I'm going to be crude here, but everything. And you're the professor, so tell me a spot mm-hmm. where I'm wrong in history that I'm wrong. To me, when the guy said we're going to have inflation in 2021, but by the way, it'll come back in 2022. I'm going to say that a little bit of inflation is like being a little bit pregnant. There is no such thing as a little bit.
A little bit, you know. A little bit of inflation is not necessarily like being a little bit pregnant, but positively trending inflation might be closer to being, you know, on your 9-month pregnancy cycle.
Well,
analogy there.
Yeah.
Awful analogy there, but I think you know what I'm trying to say there. Is a little bit's okay, and a little bit's kind of expected. It's worked for us for, you know, some time now, so it's hard to argue against that. But, the trend of inflation is continuing higher is something that's very disturbing, because once that train gets going in one direction, it is difficult to slow it down and then turn it around.
Well,
it's very difficult.
I'm
afraid they're going to lose control of it.
I'm going to define what, again, you're not supposed to talk about monetary theory these days. You're not supposed to look at money supply numbers. As a matter of fact, they're stealing them from us. But I'm going to say that if your growth every year is 2%, and your money supply growth is 3.5%, the theorist would say that over a period of time, you're probably going to have a 1.5%, somewhere between 1% and 2% inflation. But that to me would be kind of a little bit, okay, that's sustainable at the little bit level. But you don't have 8 or 9% for 7 or 8 years, pushing it to 25% last year when you have growth of 0, and say, oh, the first 2% you see, is that's all it's ever going to be. Why would you ever even think that? I mean, we're not talking about a little bit more growth than real, you know, money supply growth than real growth. We're talking about, you know, 25 times.
A lot.
You know, I mean, so why would you ever think that it's going to get to 2% and stop there? I mean, I can't think of any place in history that happened. Can you?
No, not at all. Unless they've got some sort of, you know, master plan to reduce the amount of money outstanding without hurting anybody, which is darn near impossible.
Well, what about your...
Basically, the value of everything else has to catch up with the amount of money that's out there, and that's inflation.
Well, can't you just do with what your favorite politician did, wage and price controls, Nixon?
You know, it's funny you throw that one out there, because I'm afraid that could actually happen again. You guys were talking in the first hour. You guys were talking about all these knee jerk reactions that have, you know, put us in a worse place than we probably could have been. Although Monday morning quarterbacking is pretty tough, don't tell me there won't be some sort of knee jerk reaction from Congress to say, the price of gas can't go over $4 a gallon or something like that when things start to get out of control. But don't think, especially with the group that's basically in the majority right now, you can't tell me that they just automatically won't impose some sort of knee-jerk reaction to appease the masses.
All right, and
that'll make things even worse.
Well, you realize the can of worms you just opened up.
Oh, I know, and that's why it was in the back of my mind.
Two things.
But you started in that direction.
Well, two things that are somewhat phenomenons here. One is, I'm going to say that, well, if you get any economist over the age of 55 and say what's the worst economic policy in the history of this country, 90% of them are going to say Nixon's wage and price controls, I would guess. But the other thing is when you mention the people that are in power, Nixon, his group was the Republican conservatives, and they did it. Why... What does it say to you? I'll ask you, because I don't know the answer to this. What does it say to you that you think the liberals are going to do it this time? Because they forget about last time. They're too young to remember. They're too dumb. What? Why?
I think it's the too young to remember for a big portion of the loud folks that, you know, that are in Congress now. I totally think they're too young to remember. Most people are too young to remember, and They're gonna look at it on the surface, and they're gonna say, "Well, yeah, if everybody's upset over prices rising so quickly, let's make a law that they can't, and they'll do it."
Dude,
I wouldn't be shocked if it's done. I wouldn't be shocked if things like that are done by an executive order.
Do you remember any of that? Are you too young?
Barely. I'm a little bit younger than you. My actual first memory, one of my earliest memories is being set down in front of the TV to watch Nixon resign, and
I am not a crook.
I asked, I was about 4 or 5 then. I asked my mom, "What's this all about?" And she goes, "Well, this guy was telling some stories," and I thought he was going to tell me a freaking bedtime story.
Oh God!
Stories is lies in the South.
Well, the interesting part is, I remember it somewhat. Well, what year was that? Boy, oh boy. It's a
73, 74.
So I was
like
a,
I'd have been about 6 or 7.
So we were talking about it in economics class at Notre Dame. It was 73, 74, but it wasn't just something simple like, by the way, nobody's getting a raise and nobody can raise any prices. I mean, that's not America, right? Because the big bitch that everybody had was, hey, they're supposed to be wage and price controls, and the gasoline's up another 20 cents from last week. What the bleep? Well, then there was, if it came through the supply chain, if you could document that it was a raise to you, like we couldn't control the Arabs, right? Right, so they're going to raise it from Saudi Arabia. So if you could somehow document that your gas station, that the price came to you higher, that you could, there were a million, the thing had to be, you know, the usual bazillion pages long. But you could easily, if you knew what you were doing, raise the prices, unless you happen to get caught. If your lease went up and if the price of gas, in other words, you might have the wholesaler get it to you for 8 cents more. Well, by the time you paid him, you got to do that 8 cents plus some other stuff. If you actually had other prices, or if you, in other words, it didn't stop stuff from going up, which of course had people totally pissed off because every company used it as a way to not give you a raise. Because that was easy to do. What? Russell, I'd love to give you a 10%, but geez, there's this rule that just came out for this guy, Tricky Dick. I'd love to give you a raise, but I can't do it. Yeah, but the gas still went up 10 cents. Well, I don't know how that guy's doing it, but there's no way. I don't want to get in trouble by giving you a raise. You know which part went over the fence last on this one? The part would be us. Right, but I mean, it wasn't just as simple as nothing goes up. I mean, right? That would be totally un-American. So some people, may not like Bandits because they were able to raise their prices and other people couldn't. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. We don't. Well, we're trying the money supply game again, right? You know.
Yeah, I feel like if the Fed's out of loses the ability to control things to the best of their ability, which I feel like they're reaching that point already. It does go over to, you know, the other branch. I just thought of the Fed as a branch of government, but it does go over to the fiscal policy, and that brings the president and Congress into play. As much as executive orders have been used by the last three, four presidents, really the last three presidents, including the current one, I really wouldn't be the least bit surprised if all of a sudden, you know, we get some sort of executive order that says, you can't raise prices more than this percent. And it's just an executive order that says that, and then how in the world do you enforce it?
Well, you don't. You give people a reason to bitch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you basically tell people to take a picture of the gas sign down the street, and if it's this much higher, send it in to us, and we'll find those guys.
Or just a reason to run in there.
Then they'll expect us to tell on people that are not following the rules.
We'll give you an excuse to
right back to what we were talking about, me being a bank teller and turning in drug dealers.
Or the poor girl sitting behind the counter making $12 an hour, you have a chance to run in and yell at her.
Yeah.
And that helps the world a real lot, right? S&P Futures up 16, NASDAQ Futures up 96. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Are you one of the millions of people who suffer with pain? Do you wake up in the morning with stiffness in the lower back or neck? Why are you using medication to cover up the symptoms without treating the actual cause? Painkillers, muscle relaxants, and anti-inflammatories are not the answer. At ChiroMed, physicians are trained to detect the cause of your symptoms and to correct the underlying problem. If you're ready to listen to common sense and do what it takes to make changes in your body that can affect your health for the rest of your life, give ChiroMed a call and set up a complimentary consultation. They are located in Orland Park and can be reached at 708-403-2727. 20,000 patients over 22 years have been treated at ChiroMed, and over 90% of them have had positive results without medication or expensive surgery. Isn't it time you did something good for your body too? Give ChiroMed a call. 708-403-2727. That's 708-403-2727. Let's get you pain-free and living again.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you're aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Holley, Mr. Merle Weber. And the board, S&P futures up 15, the NASDAQ futures up 74. Let me get the rest of this stuff up here. I was trying to dig through Janet Yellen's latest utterance in a Mary Berry's $21 million, Manny. So I want you to do traffic, weather, sports while I dig all the rest of this stuff up. You wouldn't mind?
I don't mind at all. 34 minutes past the hour. Good morning once again to everyone out there. We're off to a decent start here on the area expressways, roadways, and tollways outside of the Eisenhower. That's been our issue all morning, and now there's a disabled vehicle blocking the left lane on the inbound side just before East Avenue, it looks like. Solid traffic. Expect delays on the Ike. It's been slow moving all morning, and now you throw in a disabled vehicle, and that's been an issue. Same for the Stevenson. No disabled vehicle, but a lot of traffic volume on the inbound I-55 as well. Those are our two slowest moving expressways. Kennedy's starting to build as you're heading into downtown, but no accidents to report. Eden's looking good. Same for Lakeshore Drive in both directions. Southside expressways have been quiet all morning. Off the expressways, looks like we have one crash in the area. It's in Lombard. Main Street at East Prairie Avenue, there's a crash, but everything else all quiet out there. Weather today, lots of sunshine, but mild temperatures, well below normal, about 15 degrees below normal, as we'll reach a high of just 51 today. But sunny, right now it's clear and 45 degrees downtown. For our Phoenix listeners, sunshine with a high of 99 today. Right now it's clear and 67. In sports, the Cubs swept a day-night doubleheader yesterday at Wrigley over the mighty Dodgers. 7-1 in Game 1 was the final, and then 4-3 in walk-off fashion in Game 2 in 9 innings. Of course, the doubleheaders are 7-inning games now. It was the 6th or 7th time in Major League Baseball history that a team swept a doubleheader against two Cy Young Award winners, Cubs beating Kershaw and Trevor Bauer yesterday, so that's of note. White Sox had no problem in Cincinnati. They blew out the Reds 9-0. Diamondbacks lost to the Marlins 9-3. In hockey, the Blackhawks were blown out by the Hurricanes 6-3. Bulls were off. They're back in action tomorrow night against the Hornets. Suns beat the Cavs 134-118. Chief.
A quick comment on the game that just goes to show you the guy in L.A., the second guy. I didn't see what's his name get racked out in the first, but Bauer?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy had absolutely nothing last night in terms of what he normally
had. He couldn't find the strike zone at all.
But
he was just off.
Still, he has so much stuff, you still can't hit him.
Right, yeah. His thing is walking, guys. I mean, his stuff is just incredible. But he couldn't, for whatever reason, he had a mechanical thing going last night. He couldn't find the strike zone.
But you also couldn't hit him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was all over the place. He was able to hit the bull last night. You see the one where Sutcliffe was giving him no end of grief? You see the one where he didn't make it to the dirt?
Oh, yeah, I did. Yep. He bounced one before
Russell,
the dirt.
He throws his curveball, or whatever it was. It was a big, the cameras are so good. The camera kicked up a big chunk of grass. He hit the grass, and the grass is flying through the air toward the batter. I don't think I've ever seen that before. But I have a question, because I want to talk about this Treasury funding here, something boring like that. But before I do that, Manny, we have guys, not that our former guest Shanny has an opinion on anything, but guys like him are absolutely...
I miss Shanny.
So do I.
When's the last time you seen him?
I missed him, too. Like, he called me last night.
No, you don't miss him anymore.
I won't miss him for another week. But it's small doses. No, I mean, I love Shanny. But I mean, you could go from really missing him to not missing him in a flash. Let's put it that way. he was all over me last night about why I haven't gotten my shot yet. I said, because I have the antibodies, and as soon as somebody says that they start to wear off, I'll be the first guy in line. I mean, I don't think that people who have the antibodies necessarily got to go get a shot like that day. Well, if you talk to a doctor, and I'm going, Manny, or Shanny, I could talk to 15 different doctors, and I don't think many of them are going to say the day you have antibodies you need to go get a shot when you already got them. I said, there's no question that at some point I'm going to need it here. I know that, and I'm not afraid to go get it, but of course, whatever. But anyway, I forgot where the hell I was going with this. But he's one of those guys we should just fire all the umpires, right? Now my question is, when you see that box, you know, the thing on TV to where you can tell.
Yeah, the pitch tracks.
Well, is that a standard box? So if I go up there when I used to be 6'4", are they using the same box on me as if I was 5'4", or does that thing adjust?
It adjusts. Yep.
So
I'm positive. Yep.
Okay, so it's supposed to adjust for the guy.
Absolutely, yep, within the rules of the strike zone, which are, what, the bottom of the knees to the, what is it, the belly button or something? It's clearly defined.
No, it's higher than that. It's the bottom of the letters, I think.
Yeah, something like that. It's clearly defined, and it's adjusted, yep.
Okay, so they...
And then the umpires are graded on that accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Right, so they make an attempt to, when they show the thing low to a guy who's 5'4", it's not because they're using the same box as if the guy was 6'4".
Right.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yep.
All right.
By the way, real quick, Kevin writes, and of course it's Cinco de Mayo today.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, I meant to ask while on the show this morning, is a Cinco de Mayo margarita in the morning considered juice for breakfast? And I would say yes, it is.
Yeah.
I would say go,
absolutely.
go right ahead.
Remember we had the Tito's guy came in and wanted us to start drinking in the show?
That's right. We actually, this was several years ago.
Yeah.
But the owner of Tito's Vodka, who's now, you know, a gazillionaire, but at the time.
He was just a regular guy.
He was a regular guy, and Tito's was very big in Texas, but it had not, you know, spread across the country, and it had not entered the Chicago market yet.
This had to be like when we first started.
Yeah, it was probably 10 or 11 years ago, and we got a call or an email from their marketing and just said, hey, we're planning to launch big in the Chicago market, and we'd like to, you know, come on the show and promote Tito's Vodka. And we said, absolutely. Like, who's coming? You know, your PR person? They're like, no, the founder. Okay. And he brought us each a bottle of vodka and a couple of golf shirts, and was spectacular.
And a cooler.
And a cooler. And then sure enough, Tito's Vodka just absolutely destroyed the, you know, the Absolutes and Smirnoffs of the world in the bar market. And now that's the vodka of choice for everyone I know.
They came in a tremendous price point, and
it's really good. Yeah. I mean, for the price point, it's as good as it gets, I think. And
that's the number one vodka you have right now. It used to be Absolute.
Yeah. And now Tito's is just everywhere. And
is it still,
that guy famously, was a real estate guy. And, you know, semi-successful, just a realtor in Austin, Texas, I believe. And then he would make vodka on the week, you know, just for fun at home. And he would bring vodka to parties with his friends. And then they would all be like, man, this is what you should be doing. Like, your vodka is really good. So we went to some liquor stores and said, hey, you know, do you want to carry my vodka? And they said, hey, look over at the shelf. All the vodka bottles were covered in dust. And they said, why do we want to carry your vodka? We can't sell the vodkas we already have. So he just kept working at it and working at it until he was able to basically do blind taste tests to people, and they would choose his vodka, like, repeatedly. And then once that happened, he said he's still using that same recipe. He put, like, $80,000 on multiple credit cards and just went for it. And then now look at him.
When he was
That wasn't even that long ago. That was, like, in the last, like, 15 or 20 years.
Oh, yeah. When he was doing that, there were two or three other vodkas that we... that sent stuff to us. I don't know if I told you about the time, but there was one out of Minnesota that was an organic vodka, Prairie or something.
Okay.
It was really good, too. But there were probably three or four that were looking for this kind of organic, handmade, whatever they wanted to call it, niche. And these guys just kept pushing it, and they kept doing better and better. And wherever they got in the Chicago area... I don't know. It's not Southern Beverage, I know, because they would love to have it, and they don't have it. So it must be, what's his name? Wirtz must have it.
Yeah, probably.
And it's been because going back in history, because I know people in that business, for a long period of time, it was Bacardi, because rum was the number one drink. Everybody drank rum and Coke. I absolutely hate rum. Yeah, well, you know what? Rum mixed with anything like that, but if you get a really good rum and have it as an after dinner drink and like a snifter, it's really good.
Well, when you're down, if you go down in Miami, and I've never been to the Caribbean, I'm sure if you went to the Caribbean,
that's what I'm talking about, the good stuff.
But yeah, that's no one's drinking whiskey there for their drink on the rocks. They're drinking really good rum on the rocks, and that is pretty good. But I think when I was like in high school, I had some bad rum experiences drinking the cheap stuff, and I can't even smell that stuff now.
Oh, what big is it? I'm saying Bacardi was number one, then it became Absolute. They took over everything, and then of course everybody had the different flavors. The flavors weren't because people wanted them; the flavors were to make sure that Absolute got five different spots at the bar and crowd everybody else out, right? But for years, Matty, the people who won the tests every year. We're Smirnoff Red. Smirnoff was terrific vodka. Just everybody had it in their mind as a bar vodka.
Yeah.
And that was it. But they won all. So now, I should not ask this question in the last couple of years, but it's, what's the Irish booze is the number one thing to have?
Jameson?
Jameson.
Yeah, for a shot, yeah.
Well, but I mean, it was the highest selling liquor.
Yeah, it's everyone's shot of choice. It's cheap and, you know, it's relatively, smooth.
Well, for a while it was Jägermeister was putting
which that I don't get.
Well, they were putting the ice. Danny Callahan, they don't Callahan's, go figure. Remember those things, Russell, where they had the machines that kept them cold?
Oh yeah.
Well, he said he put that thing in there. Yeah. It paid for itself in like 2 weeks.
I bet that was hugely. When I was just out of college, that was like the shot everyone would do was Jäger, or you would drink Jäger bombs. And with Red Bull, and then it fell out of favor quickly because it was like
too sweet.
It's way too sweet, and then you mix the Red Bull in there, so you would be drunk and come home from the bar at like 2 a.m. and then at like 4:30 you're awake because you had so much Red Bull.
That
fell out of favor quickly.
Well, if you're in Europe, I went to way back in the day, I was in Denmark, and all the people in Northern Europe have this. The shots have this really high bitters liqueur, which I'm not really big on. Jägermeister is one of them. Then there's Gammeldansk, and then there's what's the other stuff? There's some stuff that they had in.
You ever heard of something called Blumerlunder?
Yeah, same. It's a bitters.
That was the shot of choice for Rhodes family gatherings.
What is that?
It's all kind of a bitters.
I think it's so high proof you can't get it in the United States. So we've got a German arm of the Rhodes family, and they would bring it over for Christmas. And when we ran out of that, we would start doing Jägermeister shot.
It's considered
that's the closest thing to a holiday tradition that we have in the Rhodes household.
I like it
doing shots after the meals.
But if you have a
an
old fashioned has bitters in it because it's supposedly
I thought that was normal. Yeah, I married into my wife's family, and I'm like, all right, let's start boozing. And they looked at me like I was crazy.
Well, the Germans have that, Smoking Dog, Westfalen Jäger. But it's all, because bitters is considered to be really good for digestion, Manny. So that's why people have, what's bitters goes what? They're an old-fashioned?
Yeah, that's why we did it.
Yeah, yeah. It's an after-dinner.
Yeah, an old-fashioned, yeah.
Yeah, but that's what bitters does. It's supposedly, I never used it for that, but people would say that it settled the stomach. And so all these, you drink beer and these were your shots. But they all kind of taste, it tastes kind of like cough syrup, for lack of a better term. Don't they, Russell? I mean, Vic's 44, they all kind of taste like, ugh. Anyway, I have a question for you. You must, as an economics professor, and a PhD, a FID, when people start tossing these economic terms around and using them politically, not rigorously, let's say, does it bother the hell out of you? I mean, when you hear these people talk about fiscal policy and fiscal, your stuff like your Infrastructure Act and stuff, do you immediately, like I do, say, wait a minute, there's no such thing as fiscal policy? When I say that, the Fed just came out and said their quarterly refunding is going to be, the Treasury is going to be $126 billion, which is like a real lot of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they went out to borrow that, which the Treasury does, if the Fed basically turned around and mooned them and said, we're not buying a nickel of it, How big of a collapse do you think that auction goes?
Oh, it would be a mess.
Because they're not,
especially because my assumption is just because we're so politically cold toward each other that that China, who had been a big purchaser of our debt, probably isn't participating as much as they used to, and. And our Fed has been making up the slack on that. So they would be scratching their heads going, what do we do next? Because who's left to buy this stuff?
The thing that I'm getting to...
It would not go well. How's that?
Because, I mean, the idea...
Bleed over into the stock market in a heartbeat.
Yeah, the whole idea of fiscal policy is that the Treasury goes out and borrows money, well, it used to be from the population, and now they obviously borrow it from other people around the world as well. But it's still, we're still over 50%. We're back over 50% local in country, right? I mean, so, but so say it's half, but the thought of doing that is not what they're talking about at all. They want the Fed to print the money and go out and buy them. So they're going to go out and they're going to borrow the money from Russell, you know, the 1% or sort of dudes, and they're going to get a commission on it, and you know the firms are going to front run it, and they're going to gather it up, and then the Fed's going to turn around and buy it from Russell. So there's going to be a two-edged transaction, because we really don't want to get ourselves, even in today's world where we don't really care about any of this stuff, we still are somewhat reluctant to just say, Joe Biden, turn on the printing press and spend whatever you want. So we have this two-step transaction, which gets you to the same place, right?
Yeah.
And but I'm saying if the Fed said no more, no mas, I don't think the $126 billion shows up, does it? Where's it come from?
They're not going to do that, but if they started to do that and they saw how poorly it was going to go, they probably would swoop in really quickly and we wouldn't reach that point. They're backed into a corner where they can't not do that. And I think that's what the problem is, or the long-term festering problem is here, is that the consistent behaviors I've heard it referred to as kind of like a balance sheet trick, where the Fed's just printing the money and then buying the debt. Eventually, that's gonna catch up with this either through inflation, or it's gonna catch up with this through. I can't see why the Fed would do what you're saying they possibly would do.
Well, because they
know the repercussions. They're stuck. They have to buy. You know, it's kind of like, I've got to buy gas from one of the gas stations in the Chicago area on a regular basis. Yeah, I'm stuck choosing. Yeah, there's a limit as to the places that I can go, and there's a limit to the number of people that are out there that would be willing to buy government debt. And if they don't show up, and I assume that the normal demand hasn't been showing up for a long time because the Fed has been supplementing the demand, that just becomes the regular thing. But can they consistently do that, through the end of time? And probably not without some pretty nasty repercussions.
But there's degrees of doing.
They're back into a corner where they have to.
Well, they may have to, but they could have to in the sense that we don't want to do this anymore and warn against it, or we can lie and say it's not a problem.
If they warn against it, that's just as bad as not doing it. And then they see the reaction. Remember when they would just mention that we may start tapering how much the asset purchases that we're doing.
Yeah.
We were coming out of the great financial crisis. Every time they just hinted that they were, that they were going to start backing off, the equity markets dropped, and then they backed off from it.
Well,
and personally, I always felt like, instead of saying I think we're going to start tapering, just start tapering, and then 6 months down the road go, by the way, we've been purchasing less of this stuff, and we've been doing less of this stuff, and things seem to be righting themselves. And I'm sure that they would love every time there's an auction to, do less and less, but to make sure the auction goes okay, they have to continue to maintain the status quo.
Russell, I think you and I somewhat rarely disagree, but we're going to disagree a little on this one. I'm going to say that if tomorrow morning the New York Fed guy, that they do most of the open market stuff out of there, I think still, I could be wrong, you know that better than
I do. No, they do.
If they call up Jamie Dimon's henchman and say, and the guy says, well, how much do you want to buy today? And he says, well, we're not only not buying, we're selling. I'm going to say that piece of news gets around as fast as if the sun didn't come out tomorrow. I don't think they can keep that a secret for 5 hours.
Oh, gosh, no.
So the idea of them being able to sneak one by it that you were just saying about, I don't think they can sneak anything by it because it's so obvious what they're doing. How do you stop buying $120 billion a month and have nobody know about it?
Well, you know, try to be less of a part of it and you know, take it down. And part of that would result in slightly higher interest rates.
But you and I...
And it's possible they're already doing that because we're...
Oh, no. The Fed balance sheet, the last 2 weeks was up $120 billion. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to say that you and I maybe have the wool pulled over our eyes for a couple of weeks, but Goldman Sachs isn't going to know in a second, and they're going to react.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not... I mean, it's not even... I just... I don't know. Question for investment. Okay, it looks like in the last few weeks, and I know you like to invest and certainly study the market, I'm starting to see some movement here into stacks. Well, clearly the winner of the year is this Freeport, right? It's up from 4 to 40.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, U.S. Steel. Some of these basic materials, and now today General Motors, you know, they're whining to beat the band about these chips, but the fact is they're going to raise the price out of their cars dramatically, and they probably end up making out like a bandit. But how would you, I even though I lived through this before, I would have a real problem if I had to talk to all my clients and say, here's the 20 companies that I think have the highest pricing power that people can't get at. And I was mentioning yesterday that Pullman had a really nice clause with Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. We got 100% of the CPI. So the contract was for $60 million, and if the CPI went up 10%, mm-hmm. it was $66 million. But I'm going to say that 40% of our suppliers, you know, maybe 35% didn't have a reciprocal agreement. So Pullman actually, even though we screwed up a bunch of other stuff, actually had a sweet deal on the inflation. But I don't know. So I'm asking you, if you were to name 10 companies, other than the monopoly stuff that you and I always talk about, that clearly those guys, I mean, your drug companies and people, they have it all the time. So, yeah, they're going to have it now. But who would you name as the 20 that, hey, Ford's going to raise the price of the pickup faster than the guys can raise the price of the fenders? I'm not so sure I could name those 20 companies, even though I've been talking about this for 50 years. I mean, I can make a stab at it, but I don't know that I'd know.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you think would be your top?
Other than the basic material companies, I've had a hard time trying to find like a. I think the primary ones everybody's already jumped into to a certain point, but I've been scratching my head on secondary ones. Ones that people haven't thought of yet.
Well, what do you think the state of...
It really just keeps bringing me back to, you know, buying a couple of ETFs that are based on, you know, maybe just the GLD ETF or the, maybe even the silver one as well, because there's industrial uses there. But I haven't spent as much time as I probably should, but when I do start thinking about it and trying to come up with a better way to profit from what I think is coming, beyond basic material stocks, it's kind of tough.
Well, Russell, what do you think the... Oh, we got a minute
maybe,
here.
Maybe shipping companies are going to be able to jack their rates on shipping things around.
I'm thinking that's... what do you think the state of...
But then they've got power costs, so it really...
Yeah.
Most people get hit on both ends. It's hard to find one that just benefits from the higher part.
Well, do you...
From the higher price part.
We only have a minute, but this is more of a next week. Maybe we'll kick this one up. What do you think the status quo is in terms of contracts like the one I just talked about at Pullman? Do you think if I've got 25 737 maxes coming at me in the next 5 years, do you think Boeing has inflation clauses in that contract? And plus, if you use the current CPI, what does that get you? All they do is lie about that. Does anybody really think that it's only been 1.5% last year? I mean, who's kidding? Nobody. What do you think the state of the... Well, it's more of a next week topic, but I wonder what these contracts look like today. since we haven't had any in such a long time.
Yeah, because it's not something that impacted them before, I wonder if it's, you know, something that really hasn't been included in the contract.
I'm wondering if you just want to be the guy at the gas station that raises the price of milk 40 cents, and if people still buy it, he goes, whoopee.
Yeah.
Hey, Russ.
So you raise them at midnight, and then you take them back out at 6 a.m. when everybody reopens.
Yeah. God. Russell, thank you very much, buddy. SP Futures up 17. NASDAQ Futures up 85. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at PTIProDirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit Nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.